Hello, everyone, and welcome into CrushTheStreet.com. I'm Kenneth Amendur, and I'm joined today with a brand new guest, someone who's going to discuss with us her knowledge, her background on blockchain, decentralized money, Bitcoin, what's going on around the world, the Federal Reserve, and just freedom as we know it. 2020 has been quite the year. Naomi Brockwell is on the line. She's an award-winning producer who hosts some of the largest blockchain and economic conferences around the world. And she's the producer for the 2015 feature documentary, Bitcoin, The End of Money as We Know It. Naomi, thank you so much for coming on Crush the Street with me today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Let's talk about, with your background, you know, and as it pertains to liberty, freedom, and sound money, what do you make of the current situation? 2020, it seems like a dream when you think about it. We got the riots, the lockdowns, the coronavirus, which has, you know, shut down the world for a period of time. Now they're talking about second waves. And as it pertains to, you know, what is going on with our economy, what do you make of this?
I mean, you kind of summarized everything well. You missed out murder hornets. But I think things just keep happening and everyone's just like, what, really? Really? Is that now happening? It's a lot for people to deal with. You know, when all of this started and we were thinking there was going to be this pandemic sweeping the world and there'd be all this death, and then governments, you know, shut down everything, and then you had all these businesses going out of business. You had millions of people filing for unemployment every single week, and then, you know, then you end up with, like, everything just, it seems to be steamrolling, escalating. I don't think it's all disconnected at all. You know, I think that there's a lot of things going on, and you can imagine, like, I can see why everyone's sort of out in the streets, and if you have so many places that have just been shut down for so long, people have been inside. I think that there is a lot that is correlated between all of this, but just specifically focusing on the economy, I think that really, I mean, it's not unexpected at all what's gone on. The Fed has just been printing so much money and there's been all these corporate bailouts, and it's a disaster in my opinion, and it was completely expected. You know, we set the precedent in 08 with all the corporate bailouts then. We had all the TARP bailouts. We've never had an audit of that. It's completely opaque. Once again, you have this situation where all these places apparently got money, but there's no information about where the money went. Meanwhile, we know that it's been taken out of the pockets of everyone who's a saver out there. So I just think it's a disaster at the moment. And it reminds me, you know, when Bitcoin was first created, it was created out of a crisis just like this. It was created at a time, you know, Satoshi Nakamoto released this Bitcoin white paper, and you can presume that they're working on this before the 08 crisis, but then they really amped up what was going on when all of that happened. And it was released in this perfect timing where we had this option, and suddenly everyone rallied behind Bitcoin. It wasn't a coincidence. It's because people were so angry about what was going on in the economy. They were angry about the corporate bailouts. They were angry about the corruption. They were angry about the Fed printing all of this money. And they wanted an alternative, money that wasn't at the whim of these unelected bureaucrats. And so I wonder if in this current economic turmoil, if we're going to see a reignition of this same fervor that we saw at the start, because since the creation of Bitcoin, you've had a lot of people entering the industry, a lot of major financial players in traditional finance, a lot of people who were interested in just the trading side of things, a lot of people who entered who didn't really come on board for the original ethos and didn't really understood why people were so passionate about Bitcoin. And I wonder if now that they're experiencing the same sort of economic situation that we experienced in 08, and they're kind of understanding why decentralized money, uncensorable money, why all of this is important, I wonder whether this is going to, you know, reignite that rallying cry behind this.
Yeah, it's definitely, like you said, we've reached a breaking point. You know, people were on edge with what we've seen in 2020. And so it's a real opportunity for Bitcoin to shine in this moment. And I was going to ask you this actually a little bit later on in the interview here, but, you know, what are your thoughts on Bitcoin correlating largely with the overall equities, at least in the day-to-day moves? I mean, it recovered beyond its pre-COVID prices, pretty quickly. So I will acknowledge that. But it seems like day to day, Bitcoin moves with the equity markets.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely correct. I think that it's this misconception people have about Bitcoin. You know, they think, oh, well, you know, this is going to be a hedge against economic instability or government instability. And they think of it as this safeguard. And you really have to think, like, against which government, against which economy? Because at the moment, it was a Grayscale, I think, since the halvening. You had Grayscale investing in more in Bitcoin than Bitcoin has been minted since that time. So you have giant institutional players coming in. Now, if you think like the traditional markets go down, you know, obviously when you have these major players who are invested so heavily in Bitcoin as well, like you think that Grayscale is going to be around to prop up the price of Bitcoin? Like, I think that it's just this misconception of what Bitcoin is at the moment. You can't just shout out, well, this is the reserve currency now and make it so. It doesn't really work like that. But that being said, I think that, you know, there's a difference between where we are now and what could be. I definitely see Bitcoin as being this potential reserve currency. I definitely consider it a hedge of sorts, you know, but I'm very realistic about where we are at the moment. And I think that I differ from a lot of crypto people in that it's not enough for me to say, well, I've got Bitcoin just in case and I'll use it just in case and I put some money into it just in case. That's not enough for me. I got into Bitcoin because I didn't like the sensibility of everyday transactions. I didn't like the fact that I have to ask my bank account for permission every time I want to access my own funds. I wanted another alternative. Now, there is no other alternative, or there was no other alternative, unless you just have cash, right? Unless you have cash in your back pocket, you're relying on a third party and asking their permission. Now, how are you meant to buy things on the internet with cash? It's not possible. But Bitcoin made that possible. So for me, Bitcoin and cryptocurrency is an alternative in everyday life. It's not something I want to rely on if everything in the world collapses and then I'll be safe. It's something I want to start using now to take back my data away from credit card companies, to take back my financial sovereignty and to be able to make financial decisions without having to ask permission. You know, people in Cyprus woke up one day and they had a large chunk of their bank account just missing. I don't want that to happen to me. I don't want to be holding my money in a financial institution where my money is at their whim, where it's at the whim of the governments who control those banks. So I think that Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies have a lot more power than people realize. I don't think it's necessarily just a hedge against economic instability. I think it's a tool for everyday life today. I recently did an interview with someone who has been using just cryptocurrency for years. And a lot of people say, well, I can't pay my bills in it. I can't do this in it. I can't buy my groceries. And it's just completely detached from the reality of the situation, which is that you can do all of those things. You know, I earn a 15% discount on everything I buy on the internet because I use a service called Purse. So, you know, there are lots of tools out there that I think people don't realize are there. And I think until we actually start claiming back our financial sovereignty and still until we stop feeding this system that a lot of people find so corrupt and they want to see destroyed. You know, if they're still, you know, using bank accounts, if they're still using their services, until they pull their power and their money away, those services are going to probably stay in place for a very long time. I think people need to, if they really believe in this as an alternative, start using it as an alternative today, not just hope that one day in the future when we need it, it's going to be there.
Naomi, if I was to tell you what 2020 was going to look like in 2019, you know, half the world in a lockdown sort of state, trillions of dollars getting thrown at the system. I mean, you know, the US potentially $5 trillion deficit in 1 year. I mean, and this happening all around the world, riots in the streets. I mean, my goodness, what would you think about in terms of what the stock markets would be doing, what gold or what Bitcoin would be doing, you know, how many millions of people unemployed, 40 million people unemployed here in the US. It's just these crazy numbers when you think about it. Here we are in hindsight looking at it. Speak to what you expect the economy to do, or kind of what do you potentially expect? I know it's impossible to predict, but you know, is this the middle of a crash or does this get strung along once again? And, you know, the 2025 crash, my goodness, what is that going to look like? What, how many trillions of dollars are going to get thrown at that crisis? So anyways, what are your thoughts?
And that's a great question. If we look at history, if we look at what happened in 08, you know, we kind of set the precedent there for bailouts and the amount of money being printed. And we sort of realized, oh, this is a thing we can do and get away with. And they did get away with it. They lined the pockets of a lot of their crony friends. And so now we're seeing basically the same policy, but on steroids now. Now, it's amazing how long a corrupt and rotten system can stay in place without it collapsing. So I'm not going to predict a giant collapse. I'm not going to predict what's going to happen. These things can stay in place for a very long time. Just with inertia, they can just kind of keep going along. If I'm thinking about where my money is right now, you know, it's a really tough question to know. And I expected the performance of Bitcoin to be correlated somewhat. You know, it's, if you think of Bitcoin kind of as like 90% NASDAQ, 10% gold, you know, it's probably going to be heavily correlated to what's going on in the tech world, what's going on with all the companies there and the economy in that sector. So, you know, in terms of what's going to happen in the next few years, A lot of my friends are predicting that this is the end. This is the final crash. This is where the apocalypse is going to happen. It could. I don't know. It could just keep kicking the can down the road like we have been doing. You know, the Fed just keeps printing money. Maybe we just see steady inflation and our purchasing power just sort of erode over time. It's very difficult to see what's going to happen. And as, I mean, if you're asking me like in 2019, if I could predict what would happen in 2020, for that exact same reason, there's no way I can predict what can happen in 2021, because it's very clear that everything can change in the blink of an eye. And it's just very difficult to predict these things. I think that people should be careful. I think that people should prepare in whatever ways they think they need to prepare. But I think, you know, that's good advice for any time, not just 2020. I think that people should always just be aware of what could happen and, depending on their risk tolerance, plan accordingly.
Naomi, let's talk about Bitcoin. And, you know, we talked about crisis hedge. We like gold here as well. Gold has performed quite well in 2020. A lot of people get into these polarized camps, Bitcoin versus gold and whatnot. What are your thoughts on Bitcoin versus gold? And I'll follow that up with, are they allies in your opinion?
Oh, well, I mean, I'll answer your second question first. I would say definitely, because a lot of people who are interested in gold are also interested in alternatives. You know, the reason why they're putting money into gold is because they don't necessarily trust the US dollar, or they don't trust the governments. They want something that's real. And again, not at the whim of some unelected bureaucrats where we don't get a say in what happens. So something that is driven largely by market demand, I think, is very interesting. And in that respect, Bitcoin and gold are both like that. So I think that this whole like butting heads, you know, I love gold. I think that it's great. I love precious metals in general. And it's very interesting actually to see these worlds collide. I wonder whether, again, it's just sort of inertia, maybe some people who don't quite understand the technology of cryptocurrency and understand why it has value. I would say that both have the use cases and they're not a substitute for each other at all. You know, if I want to buy something on the internet, gold isn't going to help me. And we live so much of our lives on the internet these days that having an option where we can have an alternative money on the internet that is uncensorable is very important. So cryptocurrency is very important there. And there are things that, you know, gold can do that cryptocurrency can't do as well. So there, I think that people who think that one needs to replace the other are mistaken there. I just don't agree with that viewpoint. I also think that there's a role for fiat if you want to use fiat. You know, there's a role for all kinds of different competing monetary systems and payment systems as well. And I think it's fine to adopt all of these and use them where they can benefit you across your life.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I've heard someone else I respect highly talk about crypto. He's not even a crypto guy, but his just general thesis was, I believe in competition in money.
Yeah.
And if you have that, it's going to make the dollar better, Bitcoin better, gold better, or it'll expose them for what they are. And it's potentially something that could expose and surface some problems in the fiat currency system. As fiat currencies go their way, people have options to opt out of. And of course, that might happen in other countries sooner than others. So let's get into something that you are heavily knowledgeable in. Easy to understand privacy tips, something that you cover. Why is this important? And I guess the reason why I want to bring this up is because I think people get comfortable with their Visa cards, their MasterCards. Their banks insure them, you know, say, oh, well, why do I have to care? You know, if I see something 30 days on my bank statement that wasn't my charge, I'm not even responsible for it, which is actually something that you can't do with Bitcoin, right? So, I mean, what are your thoughts on this?
I think that that's a great point. And honestly, I don't think that crypto is for everyone. I think that there are some people who benefit heavily from having their money in a bank. There are some people who are fine with being told what to do and what they can and can't purchase and how much they are and are not allowed to pay for certain items. We've seen a lot of price fixing during this corona pandemic, and governments issuing orders about which businesses can and cannot function, how much you are and are not allowed to spend on certain products. Like, there's a lot of control around here. So some people are quite happy to live within that system and some people are not. And I think it's fine either way. It's an individual preference. Personally, having control over your money is so important. And so privacy really feeds into this because, first of all, you know, if you're using the traditional financial system, you have to realize that your transactions are not private in that system. It's completely tracked and monitored and stored in the database associated with your name. And it's just this insidious system, I feel, you know. If you look at like history, if you look at any society where it's just presumed that they're being monitored or tracked or watched, there's this chilling effect that comes across a society. And it's not a matter of saying, well, I'm not doing anything wrong, therefore I don't mind being tracked. I don't mind everything being out in the open. It is, first of all, you need to realize that there are people who are under pressure in society who are also not doing anything wrong, but who powerful people may want to stop. I'm talking about human rights activists. I'm talking about political activists. I'm talking about whistleblowers and, you know, lawyers and all kinds of people. You know, even when it comes down to like, if your spouse is abusing you, that's someone who may value their privacy. So there are all kinds of situations where privacy is so important. And I think that as a society, we need to change the narrative and start getting uncomfortable about the amount of tracking going on. Because if we create a society where we can't have whistleblowers, where we can't have people holding others accountable for their actions, that's a dangerous society to live in. Now, at the moment in Congress, you've got the Earn It bill that is being trying to push through. This is being led by Bill Barr and Lindsey Graham, and these have been two very vocal opponents to end-to-end encryption. And across the board, everyone is saying that this is a ploy to end end-to-end encryption. For those who don't know, I'm not sure your viewers understand encryption, but basically end-to-end encryption is necessary if you want to have private communication on the internet. Otherwise, you know, third parties can listen into your phone calls and your messages and communications. And again, people may say, well, I've got nothing to hide, I'm fine with that. But I would have two counter arguments to that. My first one is, there are lots of instances in your life where you are going to be unhappy with people seeing what you're doing, and what you're doing is perfectly legal. For example, you close the bathroom door when you go to the toilet. You're not doing anything illegal, but you value your privacy. So I think it's actually not correct when people say that, you know, they don't care about privacy because they have nothing to hide. Number two, I think that there's a situation in society where you don't actually want a perfectly legally enforced society. Laws get changed because public opinion changes. And you have people, you know, you have Rosa Parks who went out and went against a law. And that was only the only reason that that got changed. You have people going against marijuana laws and getting that changed so people can benefit from, you know, medical uses of this that helps seizures, that helps migraines, that helps cancer sufferers with their nausea. And so there are all kinds of things that only get changed because you have people out there, you know, with doing civil disobedience, being trailblazers and all of this. If you have a perfectly static society where everything is monitored and the laws will never change because people are afraid to speak out against them or do anything against them or will be shut down if they start to be vocal against them, that's a really dangerous society to live in. You want a dynamic society. You want one that where the laws are constantly shifting and being reevaluated and changing depending on, you know, new things that we learn and things like that. So I just think that this whole, like a lot of people are very comfortable. They're very comfortable with being watched and having everything tracked and monitored. I am not so much. I think that privacy is incredibly important. And one of the things to remember is that if you are the one person who's protecting their privacy, who's using these encrypted things, you know, you kind of stand out in the crowd. We only enable privacy in a society by everyone doing these things, really, where it just becomes pervasive, where it's ubiquitous, because you don't want the people who really need these protections to stand out. You want to help protect them too. So I kind of see it as this this role in society. It's sort of your duty as a good citizen to help protect those who need it as well, my personal point of view. Privacy is a difficult thing because it's difficult. And online privacy, especially, is just really, really difficult. You have the NSA that's cracked almost all kinds of encryption, and it's unclear which ones still aren't cracked. You can presume that if they're trying to ban certain types of encryption, it's probably because they haven't cracked them yet. You have this tremendous push further and further from governments towards just everything being transparent and out of the open and away from privacy. That's never going to change. They're always going to want that because it helps them do their job. But as citizens, we should push back against that because that creates a dangerous society that is very imbalanced in terms of the power that people have. So I think that people do need to stop being so complacent and realize how much of their conversations is completely accessible to large numbers of people. There's this presumption of privacy. In fact, like there's one, did you ever see that John Oliver clip where he was interviewing people? It was just after the Snowden revelations. And
I didn't see it. I might have seen something on Twitter, but I didn't actually see the clip.
I mean, it's kind of hilarious because he goes to Times Square and he asks people, it's like, I don't know whether I can swear on your show or not.
You can.
I can. Well, he goes to Times Square and he asks people, would you be comfortable if the government had copies of all your dick pics? And everyone responds like, that would be terrible. No, I'd be completely against that if the government had that. And he was like, right, you know, asking these women, like, you know, if your husband sent your picture of his penis, would that make you, and the government could get it, would that make you uncomfortable? And they're like, that would be outrageous. I would not stand for that. And then he asked them, do you think that this dick pic program exists? And they all said, absolutely not. That's ridiculous. Of course, there's no program that, you know, in the government that allows that. So people have this presumption of privacy, and most people don't realize how far that's been violated right now. Of course, the government has access to every SMS you've ever sent, every email you've ever sent. You know, these are inherently insecure platforms, and people don't realize that everything is just transparent. Again, it's all attached, it's stored in a database for all time attached to your identity. So people don't realize this. And I think that education is needed to let people know how far their privacy already has been violated and let them know what they can do to push back against this.
So I think it's interesting because I think about that a lot. And I think people have this assumption that there's just too many people for the government to just single out one person. You know, I think that's where they know their privacy is out there, but they probably are a little more comfortable that there's just millions of people in this world and no one has time to bother with them. And maybe you can comment on that.
Absolutely. That's a huge misconception, because these things are not transient things, that they're not going to watch us in real time, that therefore they're going to miss what we're doing and we're not of interest. The fact is that everything we've ever done online is being stored in a permanent database. Snowden, you can see my background, my permanent record book, he literally wrote an entire book about our permanent records, about all the things that are being stored forever. So this is not this transitory thing where it exists, it's ephemeral, it disappears. If in the future anyone, any snarky bureaucrat, any political person, anyone who has access to any of this stuff, and it's all stored in a database, it's accessible to people. So if anyone has any beef with you and wants to get you for anything, they can, because the fact is we're committing on average 3 felonies a day that we don't realize. You know, the Bar Association in New York tried to count the number of laws in existence, criminal laws that would get you sent to jail. They stopped because they couldn't do it. There are too many. It is not possible for even a single organization to know every law in existence and actually be have an understanding of what they are. So the fact is, all of us are constantly committing crimes that we don't realize. And all of that is being stored forever. So if anyone ever wants to get you for anything, they just have to go through this record. And you have to think, well, no one's ever going to try to get me. I'm a nobody, you know? So what, you're never, ever going to have an opinion that differs from people with political power? I mean,
maybe
that's
crazy.
Maybe you
want to run for president, then you're screwed.
You know, I mean, so of course you're going to have unfavorable opinions. I would hope that people continue to have unfavorable opinions and have independent thoughts and think for themselves. But the fact is, we're getting into a scary situation in society where that may not be possible in the future, because there's a lot of thought policing going on. There's a lot of bureaucrats out there who, you know, do snarky things and go against individuals and get them for things. And they have all of the data that they need to get you for anything at all that they want. I mean, we have the Fourth Amendment for a reason. It's to go against unreasonable searches and seizures. So, you know, we had created this warrant system so that if you have someone who specifically committed a crime, you are looking for specific evidence related to that at this specific place, and it's all detailed. And these warrants were really important because that specificity is important. They don't want you saying like, well, I think you killed that person, but you know, I'll go through your house, I'll rifle through everything. If I find anything illegal, then, you know, I'll put you away for that because I think you did this, but I don't have the evidence to prove it. But that's exactly the situation we live in right now, because this Fourth Amendment, for some reason, doesn't apply to our digital lives. There are dragnet captures in all of our search history. The FBI has just been given that, you know, they amended the Patriot Act and just increased its powers, you know. So these are things that are already unreasonable. They complete access to all of our, you know, SMS messages, all of our emails, all of our online activity. You don't even have to, did you know this? You don't even need to press enter in a Google search for the things that you typed out and then decided to delete to be stored. Because what actually happens is in real time, that's all being captured by Google. That's all being stored. It goes through these different programs, through the NSA. Everything you do online passes through NSA servers. They decide whether it's going to go through passive capture or active capture. If it's passive capture, that just gets stored. If it's active capture, then it gets rerouted to another NSA server where they get a piece of malware, they insert it into your internet traffic, and now they've captured your entire device. That's it is, you know, you could trigger that if you look for any trigger words like protest or, you know, anonymous VPN or anything like that, that's going to trigger these words and then your device is going to be captured. Again, Snowden detailed all of this in great detail, and it's terrifying that all of this, you know, is in the power of certain people, and it just seems like such an imbalance in society. I mean, it's truly worrying to me.
It really is. Naomi, it's interesting how things can get implemented for whatever reason. Again, the shock of 2020, we had this virus that took place, and now people are talking about privacy. There's a lot of people worried about the excuse of being tracked because the government wants to know if you're sick or not, and then who you were in contact with, and all of these things that, again, are an excuse to take our privacy for the sake of you know, society's well-being. Any indication as to the fallout from what we're seeing over the last couple months, and you know, how much damage is being done to our privacy in 2020?
That's a really great question. I actually did a prediction video a couple of months ago of what I think the fallout is going to be. Some things may get better. You know, you may have more investment in tech sector and remote services and biotech, all of this. But I think that privacy is going to take a huge hit. Now, the problem with these emergency measures is that the emergency never ends. We learned that from the Patriot Act. This was a temporary stopgap measure that just kept getting reauthorized and reauthorized. And I think that we have to be very careful as a society, knowing that these things do just get reauthorized, about what policies we want to implement right now. Now, as you mentioned, you've got all of this tracking apps, and some people don't mind that because they're like, listen, whatever can help us shut this virus down, it's fine. But there are good ways to do this and there are bad ways to do this. It is entirely possible to create a contact tracing app that protects an individual's anonymity and protects their privacy. And if you have governments who are trying to wave through these policies saying like, quick, it's really important that we just pass this quickly, because you know, time is of the essence. If we're not discerning about these policies, we are going to institute like disastrous policies for our privacy that really does, you know, steamroll this Orwellian surveillance state nightmare that we already are on the path of. So I think that it's super important that we take a step back, we actually look at measures, and we do things carefully and correctly. We should be talking to privacy experts about ways to do this, because it is possible. And anything less than that, I don't think people should settle for at all.
Naomi, thank you so much for coming on Crush the Street with me today. I'd like to give you an opportunity here to share some closing thoughts and just maybe any words of wisdom that you'd have for anyone, and then share with us anything else that you would have for us, if people can learn more about you and future things that you might have down the pipe.
Yeah. Well, if anyone wants to learn more about all this stuff and privacy and the latest egregious oversteps that have occurred, you can find all of the ways to contact me on my Cointree page. So that's cointr.ee/Naomi Brockwell. You can find link to my Twitter, my memo.cache, my read.cache, my library page, my BitChute account, my YouTube channel. All of those are on there. I tend to be on like all of the decentralized media platforms, all the alternative media platforms. I think it's important to be supporting those right now, because I think that we are increasingly needing them as a society. We need these alternatives. So you can head over there, find out all the places where I am. Also has all my crypto addresses on there too, if you fancy sending me a message on there and saying, hey, I saw the show. Have you got a Cointree page? If not, you should set one up. Then all of your fans can send you a message and just thank you for the shows that you're doing. But yeah, you can find everything there. I would say like parting words of wisdom, just be vigilant, research these things, be careful. Don't ever have a presumption of privacy in anything. Presume that everything you're doing online is being captured, is being monitored, because it's very hard to have robust privacy. Does that mean that we should give up trying? Absolutely not, because there are amazing technologically advanced people out there who are creating awesome tools for us every day. And it is possible, even though it's hard, it is possible to live a life that still has, you know, control over your decisions. But I would say just support the platforms out there, support the people out there that are already trying to give you these tools so that you can live a more free life. That would be my closing thought.
Great words. Thank you so much, Naomi. Appreciate your time here with us at Crush the Street.
Thank you so much.